G'day everyone, Wind Against Tide is back and live at the Melbourne Boat Show for 2023, our first broadcast coming out of our little stall here. We've got merch here, some fishing gear, it's going great guns, but I'm excited because I'm joined today in studio by Jonah Yick, Tasmanian correspondent, big fish catching extraordinaire, and I've also got Lockie O'Reilly, the local young gun on the big southern bluefin tuna, fresh off a stage talk. He's come in to join us. How are we going, the both of you? How are you, Jonah, first of all?
Really good, Dave. I'm still recovering from the jet lag from my 1 hour grueling flight, but yeah, I think I'm ready to go. I'm good.
Did you have your passport on hand? They let you come over here?
I sure did, yeah. No, and the weather's turned it on, so yeah, no, pumped.
Not fishing this weekend, just here for the socialising and the back slaps?
Exactly, the fishing will come after, hopefully.
Yeah,
I've got
good.
A reputable angler that'll be taking me out on the snapper. So.
Obviously not me.
Oh, so he's got a beautiful boat, beautiful big Eden craft, and the bite's supposed to be good, so there's no excuses.
I don't know anyone with a big Eden craft. Although Lockie's got a nearly Eden craft, don't you, Lockie?
Yeah, something. It's on its way. It's coming out soon. We'll see.
Oh, okay. That's a secret.
On the hush, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, good to know. All right. So, yeah, anyway, I should probably introduce. We've got Lockie O'Reilly. He's a local young gun on the tuna. So you've just had a chat on the stage, Lockie, about catching southern bluefin.
Yep.
That all went pretty good?
Yeah, it went really well. Just talked a lot about catching and about all the tagging release, and then if we're going to take a tuna, how we're going to process it, how to find it, and doing all the techniques.
Awesome. So it's pretty fortuitous that I have Jonah and Lockie in here with me today, because Jonah's a fisheries scientist, of course, and Lockie recently had what we would have thought a while ago would be a once in a lifetime recapture, Jonah, but this is the second time attack happened in the last 2 years.
Yep.
Do you want to explain a little bit about this special fish that Lockie's recaptured?
Yeah, so this is pretty amazing. I mean, generally with tag tuna, the chances of a recapture are very slim. I mean, Dave, how long have you been fishing for, tuna fishing?
Oh, probably a good 15 years. I must be getting old.
Yeah. And I think I'd be pretty similar as well. And how many tag tuna have you caught?
Zero, my friend. I've tagged a few. I've never recaptured.
Exactly. Same with me, right? I mean, these are pelagic fish. They move a long distance, and generally they're just hard to encounter on the water. And in a way, it's also a good thing, saying that the stocks are in reasonable condition. Mm. They are recovering. You'd certainly be worried if you're getting a lot of tag recaptures.
Yes.
But for some reason, Lockie here seems to be a magnet for recaptures. So not only has he caught a very significant tagged fish, which was in September this year, a few months earlier he caught another tagged fish, which was also very different to the standard tag that we'd use recreationally. I don't know if we're going to go down that path, because
why not? So Lockie's caught one with a small fish earlier in the year.
Yes.
We'll start with that one. Lockie, you want to tell us a little about this fish that you caught?
Yeah.
Time of year and what was interesting about it?
Yeah, so we went out, me and Dad actually, from Inverloch, targeted the southern bluefin tuna, the school fish that we like to call them. I think it was in January last year. After recently, I think you got them in the morning or the day before.
It doesn't sound like me. I don't catch fish.
Gave us a heads up, and we made our way out. And after a bit of a grueling day of some sunning fish, we eventually got some on the poppers. Dad got one to start with, and then I got one after that. And surely after bringing it in, we saw something coming out of it, and I was like, this is a tag. But again, as Jonah's mentioned, like, it's a bit different than what we'd normally find. And there's about a few 15 to 20 kilo fish, and we've sent it around to Dave and Jonah, and very, very intrigued. So Jonah can tell us a bit more about the certain tag, because I'd bugger it up, but get all the information on it.
That's a good idea. Leave the sciencey stuff to the science man.
So interestingly, so this is the second, I guess when we think about it, there's been three tagged fish which has sort of come through the Wind Against Tide podcast. The first one was Ryan Gazzola's, which was last year, which was, I think, 135 kilo, and that was, I think it was at Liberty for almost 29 and a half years. Yeah. So this was a different type of tag that Lockie got out of the smaller fish. It was actually, the only thing he saw was a thin piece of wire hanging out of the belly. There was no external tags that you'd usually see, which is what we use when we're tagging tuna recreationally. So when he's cut it open, he's found the tag, and it's like a small plastic cylinder with this wire coming out of it. And it actually ended up being an archival tag, which is a tag which measures the water temperature. It also covers depth and also can pinpoint the location, GPS location of where the actual fish has gone, its feeding preferences in the water column. So yeah, absolutely amazing. So this was tagged, I think, when that fish was, I think, 2 years old from memory. Yeah,
it was
WA.
Almost through the day as well.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Very similar. I think that was off WA.
Off WA, yeah. Yep. So it only, how long would it have been at liberty for?
I think it was...
Wasn't yeah. long. I think it was no. only maybe 3 or 4 years because yeah. it was only a small fish.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lockie was lucky enough to catch this fish. And I think from what I've heard, there's been very, very few recaptured like that, especially that style of tag, that type of tag.
you're a tin ass young fella.
Yeah, someone's got to do it.
Yeah.
So what did we learn from that one, Jonah?
So unfortunately, that was tagged by the Japanese. Some Japanese scientists, so we haven't got a lot of information yet, given it's their project. I guess the main thing is that, yeah, it was tagged in WA. It's come all the way back into Bass Strait, which previously was, that was never recognised as a tuna fishery until, the last, 4 years, 3-4 years?
Yeah. Yep.
But we actually don't know about the results of what was recorded on the archival tag, but the Japanese scientists would have, I think they picked it up from the Syro scientists, and they would have gotten a lot of valuable data, which they never would have gotten if it wasn't for Lockie catching the fish and reporting it in. So yep. Absolutely amazing.
Will we ever see the data off that, or is it top secret international stuff?
I'm not sure. Not sure about that, because it's different scientists. It's hard to say.
All right, so Lockie's recaptured a sat tag fish.
Yep.
And then fast forward to about a month ago.
Yeah.
And, well, you want to tell us a bit of a story, Lockie?
Yeah, well, again, we're headed out from Inverloch, the local stopping ground, and about, 3 kilometres from the boat ramp, headed out, 28 metres of water, and, came across some barrels. Fortunately, we had it all to ourselves and, hooked up after recently dropping one a few hours before that. We hooked up to this one and, eventually got it into the boat. I think it was 116 kilos at the weight. And again, it had one of our normal tags that we're used to hanging out of it. But this one actually had a double in it. And I think it was orange, the tags were, which normally we just get one on the side of the fin. But this had a double one. And again, mentioned Dave and Jonah and got in contact with them. And it's keep the head, keep the frame, do everything. And fortunately, from the one from summer, I knew a bit about what to do after catching the fish. And
well, I saw your Insta story and I spotted the orange tag. I'm like, it cannot be. It can't be another one. The first thing I did was message him, don't throw the frame away, because the one with Ryan Gazzola's, I had to go dumpster diving to retrieve the head the next day, and I got it just before the rubbish bin was about to pick it up, the rubbish truck.
Yeah.
So with Lockie's, it was like, keep the head, which he was already onto, thankfully. And we were thinking about bringing the head in here and hacking it up and doing some sciencey stuff on it, but we thought the blood and gore might scare a few of the punters away.
It's a bit confronting, potentially.
But yeah, so that's actually, that's about, have we learned anything off that yet, or do we need to do some...
No, we've got a bit of stuff back from that. You probably should have mentioned, Lockie, with your archival tagged fish, that frame also had a bit of a story behind it, because you end up chucking that.
Yes.
Then got back into contact with us 3 days later. What happened?
Yeah, so I did actually throw that head and frame over the side at the jetty as I was cleaning it. And
you
then,
fool!
Yeah, well, I didn't really know. And I was like, I'm just going to get rid of this because I've got to get back to Melbourne. And then, I think the next day or something, a couple of days later, went back up there, jumped in and ended up finding it wedged against the pier. And was able to retrieve it and then
that's crazy.
The head in. But yeah, I had to go for a bit of a dive and fight off the stingrays for it, but we eventually got it.
Wow.
So another good, what would you call that? It's a salvaged
The rescue
success
mission.
Story. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially down there because the tide pumps through that area. So
100%. It was just wedged up against the ramp. I was so lucky.
That's lucky. Lucky in a few instances to catch it, for it to be tagged and to be able to retrieve
100%.
Retrieve the head. So what's going on, Jonah? Why are we recapturing all these super old special fish?
I don't know. It's crazy. Like I said earlier, the odds of catching a tagged tuna are just so rare. It's basically like hitting the lottery, let alone getting two very significant tag fish in the space of 2 years in basically the same month. In the same area, it's just incredible. I just don't know how this is happening. It's crazy.
Yeah, very fortunate. And then so, that was very close to this, where the schoolfish was caught as well.
There you go. Good tuna hotspot. Mm. So correct me if I'm wrong, but how heavy was your fish, Lockie?
The barrel?
The barrel, yep.
Yeah, 117 it went.
117, right. And I think Ryan Gazzola's was a bit over 130.
Yeah.
But Lockie's one's a bit older?
I think his was... Yes, when Ryan's fish was initially tagged, it was 1 year old. I think it was only like 50 centimetres. And Lockie's was 2 years old, I think, when it was first tagged. But both were tagged, I think, in 1995 in that period. So similar tagging programs. And they were both, I think they were South Australia in the bite, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yep. And amazingly, the scientist that actually came and extracted the otoliths from Ryan's fish and is planning to come and take Lockie's was also on that exact trip where Lockie's fish was tagged back in 1995. And we found a photo of with the tagger that tagged Lockie's fish and Naomi. So you'll see that in that will be published somewhere very soon.
That's bloody incredible, Jonah.
Yeah, it's crazy. Crazy just a bunch of events which all sort of came together.
The stars aligned.
Yeah, the stars aligned. And
what about the fact that it's all happened within our like circle of contacts as well? Twice in a row, we've been able to steer people in your direction and sort it all out.
Oh, it's been crazy. And then, funny enough, back when Ryan's fish was tagged, I was sorting out all of the calls and everything else between me and the scientists and the guys while I was getting ready for a tuna trip. Exact same thing happened again. And, you know, I don't tuna fish every week, you know. It just so happened.
Yep.
So it was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah, we're looking forward to getting some more details back on that one. That's really exciting.
Yeah. So I guess the main thing with these two fish, so Ryan's fish and Lockie's fish, is what was so important is these fish were both injected with a non-toxic treatment called strontium chloride, which basically lays down a mark in the fish's ear bone, which is called an otolith. And it basically means that if we can recover the fish head when the fish is recaptured, which we were able to because Lockie kept it, the otoliths will be removed as they were with Ryan's fish. There'll be sections, so there'll be a cross-section cut through them. And then we can actually validate the age of the tuna and see if we're aging them correctly, because currently if you don't have that marked band, you're just reading the rings on the otolith, like basically like reading the rings on a tree trunk, and it's generally fairly accurate, but this is one of the few times where you can actually do it with an old fish, a significantly old fish with a mark. So it's very, very important information, which we would have gotten unless this happened. So
from the cross section of the otolith, we can tell what water temperature this fish has been in, is that right? And then we know what region it's been living in most of its life.
I think that's a further study. The sort of microchemistry of the water. I'm not sure if that'll get done with this otolith, but certainly the age and validation will be a big thing for us. I mean, the main thing is we know when it was tagged, we know when it was recaptured. Add those years on, which I think was 28 and a half years, so a year less than Ryan's. So still second longest tagged fish that's been at liberty, you know, by the CSIRO. And then you can then look at the mark on the otolith and see if that adds up to, you know, 28 and a half years. So absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it'd be amazing to see the research we get from it, especially now that we've got two to compare them to. It wasn't just a one-off.
Exactly.
And just, what the future has to hold and what we can learn from them going into targeting them further down the track.
So I've got a big question for Lockie. What is your secret for recapturing
for the taggers?
Fish? You know, I've tagged probably hundreds of tuna, and these are just conventional tags, not special tags. You know, they're just the standard DPI ones, New South Wales DPI tags, and still nothing.
Oh, we're just got to be right place, right time, and put in the hours. That's what it all comes down to. Knowing the hot spots where they are. Mm. Go out there with a satellite and track them.
Jonah knows the hot spot in his local area. He just trolls around one rock the whole time.
Yeah. I've got a few of those hot spots. Yeah. Many rocks in Tassie, you know.
Yeah. Well, we should. The science stuff's bloody amazing, but it's going to go over my head and over Lockie's head. Not over your head, Jonah. You're a brainiac, but we're just simpletons, you know. Sorry, Lockie.
Catch some fish and have a day. Here you go, Jonah.
But we want to talk a little bit about tuna fishing. We've got two of the best tuna fishers I know. And
three.
Sometimes I catch them.
Yeah.
Well, I used to back in the day anyway. So I want, is this putting on your spot if I ask for your three top tips from both of you? And they might turn out to be the same thing because you're probably thinking along the same lines of how to go out and target, and I'm going to say big southern bluefin tuna.
Nope.
Do you want to start, Jonah?
Yeah, okay. I guess one big thing would be perseverance. So know that, you know, generally the bite times are small, the windows are small. You might get a good day where you get multiple shots, but generally you got one shot and you got to make it count. So if you can start at first light, you know, that's a peak feeding period of big tuna. And if you can grind it out, if you don't get one first light, if you can keep grinding and grinding and still don't do any good throughout the middle of the day, wait till last light. Generally, not only is it a good bite time, but also your chances of less boat traffic potentially are less, and that just means you've got more opportunity for that one bite. My second tip would probably be keep looking around for signs of life, and it could be a range of life from mutton birds, sometimes even seagulls. It could be gannets. It could be feeding albatross on top. It could be seals just, starting to group. Depending on where you go and the areas you're fishing, they can all differ a little bit depending on the size of bait. So you can't get too focused on one sign. I used to love seeing gannets diving in, but most of the time these days you're finding other signs of life which are just as consistent for big tuna than big whales, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because traditionally when you see gannets, you get very excited. But the thing is, the gannets are eating pilchards. Mm. And just because they're eating pilchards doesn't mean it's tuna underneath them pushing it up. Yeah. So I don't know about you guys, but I always find it's got to be the right kind of life. As in, like personally, if I see dolphins working bait, especially in our region, and I think it might be a bit different for you guys, Jonah. Mm. But if I see dolphins working bait and seals, then and there's gannets in the vicinity, then I get pretty excited.
Yeah. Again, it seems to be very different. I mean, I don't think I've ever caught a big tuna off dolphins, but even the guys in Tassie in Bass Strait, they pull a lot off dolphins and whales. But generally, off Eagle Hawk Neck on the southern area, it's more the albatross, the terns, the gannets, the seals. You know, big balls of seals working hard. That's what really gets me excited.
Mm. And the seals down there are savage, aren't they?
They are. So that's the other issue, you know. As much as they're great, a great indicator for a good bite, hooking the big fish isn't the start of the battle, really. You've got to beat the seals, basically. They want the fish just as badly as you do. So
yeah.
And that in itself is another challenge. So
all right. So we've got fish hard all day.
Yep.
Select the right kind of life.
Yep. And I guess my third one is probably, and again, this can vary on the location, but again, in Tassie, we're very fortunate where we've got these big islands and big offshore rock islands, basically.
Mm.
And for whatever reason, the big tuna love feeding around, but it holds a lot of bait.
Well, there's your reason.
Yeah, it does. So they it holds a lot of bait, and the big tuna love it, and they'll just stick to this area. And other places, you know, in Victoria and else, other places where SBT are found, you know, you might find another area where there's a lot of bait which holds in one spot. And I guess one key is once you find those big fish, if you mark them or you see them, just stick at it, basically, and stay in that one area. Sometimes they might move off, but a lot of times they will stay in that area all day, and you just got to wait for that bite time. And generally a lot of fishers will stay. They might see the bust up once in the morning. Then if nothing happens for an hour, they move off and start to wander about. Especially with us in Tassie, we got great scenery. We got an awesome coastline. And it can get a bit boring staying in the one spot. So big tuna, you really got to be focused.
Everyone down there does the Tour de Tasman Peninsula where you come out of Eagle Hawk Neck, go do the lap around Tasman Island, back up to Hippolyte.
Exactly.
Through the Munro's Bight area, back to the ramp.
Yeah, and no doubt you still catch fish like that. You can still catch fish like that, 100%. But sometimes it just pays. If you make your plan and you've seen that there are big fish in that one spot or around a particular rock or island, just stay there and just outlast everyone else. And they are going to come up and feed again. You know, that bait's not going to go anywhere. It'll stay there. Again, if you're fishing somewhere a bit more oceanic where the bait's not held in one spot for so long, such as probably your areas in Bass Strait where bait's moving quickly, it's probably not going to work quite as well.
Yeah, it's the eternal question is, do you stay or do you go now?
Yeah. It's killed many a man and many a death spiral.
I have been of the same philosophy as you for a lot of years, Jonah, where, you know, you find an area, you're marking fish, grind it out in that area because eventually they'll come up. But then it does bite you in the ass sometimes when you stay there and just the life just dissipates and someone 15K down the track hooks up and you're like, God damn it.
Yeah.
The grass is always greener.
It is.
All right. Three brilliant tips from our main man, Jonah Yick, related to fishing in Tassmania for all you Tassie fishers. Now let's throw it over to Lockie. What's your three tips, Big Wheels?
So, Jonah did touch on some very key points. But, probably to start with, as Jonah has mentioned, perseverance. Like, the amount of times, even myself, as you go from start game fishing to, I guess, after having a bit of experience, you go, by 3-4 o'clock, let's go home. And by 6-7 o'clock, people are getting double hookups. They're hooking heaps of barrels and it's fully erupting. Yep. You're like, if I stayed there, I probably would have got one.
Yeah.
It's definitely sunrise, sunset. As Jonah said, there is a morning bite. There will be an afternoon. You can get one during the day. You just don't know. Some people, even that I know, you go out there, they'll fish the morning bite, and then at lunchtime they're fishing for gummies. And it's, work. Yeah. But it's, if you really want to persevere and really get the results, you got to grind all day long. You just never know when it's going to happen. Like, I've had it happen at 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock. Like, this is all in the last few weeks. Like, there's no key bite time. Sometimes there is, but sometimes it's all over the shop, and it's just, you got to find the life. You're covering the kilometres, but then, same thing like Jonah mentioned as well, probably the second tip. Once you've found the fish, really lock in on them. And as long as there's enough bait there, the life's there, it's not going to move 9 times out of 10. Sometimes it does. And then, get trawling around. It might even only be a couple hundred metres or a few Ks, but they will still be in that area. And just lock on, just work it. Few of us last year, like, you find it, then you bugger off somewhere else, and the person that's come back, once the boat traffic's eased, it's going off its head.
Yeah, absolutely. And they don't follow the rules, because let's talk about like a moon phase. On a full moon, traditionally, you think tuna are going to bite first light and last light, because they're going to start feeding into the night and feed under the full moon. But then I've had situations on a full moon where I've hooked up smack bang middle of the day, 12 o'clock. So as long as you got lures traveling over fish, there might be one that's stupid enough to eat a lure.
100%. It's just got to keep grinding. It's just, it can do your absolute head in at times, but that's barrel fish, and that's why the results are there, and that's why we all want the trophy fish.
Yeah.
You just got to keep grinding. And then probably the third tip, I reckon lure choice, again, trying to match the hatch, but also in that, prepare yourself for everything. So, especially this year, I've started taking out rods with sabikis on them and started catching, there's a bit of bait, rather than just taking out your stinky old pilchards, which I'll still do, but drop down and be like, what are they feeding on? We're catching yakkers, we're catching red baits and pilchards and things that I wouldn't normally have done in the past, but now I've been optimistic and being like, if it erupts in the arvo, like, we've all had it where it's going off and you're sounding 10, 30 fish each pass, but they're still not getting a lure. And then someone rocks up with a pilchard or a fresh red bait or something like that, bang, they're on instantly.
Yep.
So you just want to set yourself up for absolutely every possibility that's going to happen out there.
Yep. And it can be hard to stop towing lures around to catch the bait, but sometimes it's a calculated risk you got to make so that you're prepared when the life does pick up again in the afternoon.
100%, definitely. Yep. What about yourself, Dave? Anything to add?
No, I'm just learning from you guys. Speaking of lures, I mean, I'd love to get the other man that's helping us out here at the stall this weekend, Dave Jurisic, in for a chat, but we might get him on in a little bit, actually. But Dave makes some brilliant lures, which, by the way, are available here at the Wind Against Tide store, so come on in and grab them and have a chat to the man. But lure choices, Jonah, because me and you often argue about this. You're a big fan of small lures.
Small. If you call 6 inches small.
That's
depends who you ask.
That's an interesting conversation, actually. You're a big fan of the smaller stuff, matching smaller bait profiles.
Yeah.
Over here in Victoria, I know I run a lot of stuff that's upwards of 12 inches long.
Frightens them. frightens the fishermen. I just don't like it.
Yeah. You know? I know you've told me that in the past. But so what sort of lures are you running, Jonah?
Yep, so pretty much we, in Tassie, we mainly run 6-inch lures, even for the big fish, so big fish and school fish. You get the odd person that'll run, you know, a 10-inch size fish, but again, that's getting quite big for Tassie standards. Not to say that the fish aren't going to get it, but I think a lot of times with lures, you know, they catch the fisherman first, then the fish second, and for whatever reason, the game fishing culture in Tassie is we run 6-inch lures. I personally run Black Magic lures, as they support me with all my gear, and they work really well for me, a range of colours, and I pretty much, most of the time, I sort of experiment with different colours in different positions, but once I start to get a bit of consistency of a particular colour in a particular position, they stay in that spot, and then that's their spot for, you know, the rest of the time I'm fishing. So
is it more a confidence thing than anything with what you're running? Like, I know they say lures catch fishermen.
Yeah.
And it's nice to have the best looking spread that you can possibly get, but is it just a matter of I've got confidence in that, I'm going to tow it around until I run over a fish that's going to eat it?
I think so. For me, I mean, for me, I find confidence is the big factor. I don't get caught up too much in
fads,
lure colours, fads. Nah. Yeah. I know a lot of friends love buying lures, going to the tackle stores and getting the best and newest lure that's come out of the market. That's never been me. I mean, Dave knows me pretty well. I'm a fairly, what's the word?
Frugal.
Frugal's a good one. Yeah,
yeah, frugal.
And I love good deals. So generally I stick with
what's
a good deal or what's good value for money. And then if it works for me, I stick to that. And I don't move from that too often. And these days I go into the tackle stores and I see these other brands of lures and I cry. I mean, I look at the price and I think, Jesus, if I lose one somehow, I get a tangle, or if you know, my fish gets attacked by something bigger and it busts me off, Jesus, you know, that in itself would ruin the trip, I think.
Well, if that's your issue, you come down here and see us because we've got them at a bargain basement price direct from the maker himself. He will even tell you how he made them.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah. Oh, I might hit him up for that.
All right. What about you, Lockie? Lure choices. What are you going with?
Yeah, so I reckon the action's a big thing too, but size-wise, I've even dropped down to 8 inches this season.
Oh, there you go.
Which I did, as Dave mentioned, we run big lures a lot in Victoria, but I've even caught some on 14-inch big bakulas, like those sprockets.
Yeah.
But I'm running the bigger lures in the corners mainly, just as like a teaser to really bring them up, and then throughout the spread, dropping them down. But yeah, normal size, say 9 to 10 inches.
Yep.
But then, yeah, I've even an 8-inch lure with a thinner profile has seemed to work quite well, which I'll even drop halfway down throughout the day. The other week we were trawling around and went over fish after fish after fish, and then just had a big lures out on the rig. I dropped it down to an 8-inch lure when we had a fish swimming under the boat, and bang, got the bite straight away.
How's this, boys? We're talking tuna trolling, and the probably tuna lord of the universe is standing at the front of our stall here, Richie Arbella, our Dreamcatcher Fishing Charters. The man.
Man himself,
the original
Richie.
Barrel catcher.
How much, you?
Not bad.
Ugh. Richie, how long are you here for, mate? We've got to get you on the podcast.
I just got here, so I just finished the talk on stage on marlin fishing, so...
The marlin champion.
I reckon we do one.
Listen, I don't know if you need me. You've got Lockie, man. You've got
Channel 9 over here, Richie.
Richie's just told us we've got Lockie, so we don't need him.
Mate, the chopper's flying over. It's doing aerial shots. We've got it covered.
Don't need me.
Well, we'll have a chat to you after we've finished up here, Richie, and I would love to get you on. Beauty, mate.
Done.
How's that? That's what happens when you're live broadcasting at the boat show. It attracts all and sundry, Jonah, all the big names. So good to have Richie wandering on past. We'll get him in for a chat later.
Sounds good.
But so we covered the lure choice, did we? We're happy with what we're running?
Yeah. But yeah, colours as well, I think, is another thing. Like we said, the lures are catching the fishermen, but the tuna don't actually see colours, they're seeing shades. But I do think colours is necessary in a way. It's just, but the shade that it projects, that really tries to entice the fish, matching the hatch with the colours, with the bait choice, which again helps dropping the sabiki down, seeing what they're eating, and then matching your lures to that.
So I've got a question. What do you think about this, Jonah? Do you think for catching barrel bluefin, we are matching the hatch and trying to match a size profile of a bait, or do you think it's more effective running something that contrasts with what they're eating? I mean, like, you look at a Lumo lure, there's no fish that's that colour or shade.
No.
So do you think that they're striking at that because it's like, oh, that's something different?
Definitely. I definitely think so. I mean, you look at some of those bait balls, you've got, you know, you're competing with hundreds of thousands of other little bait fish which all look exactly the same.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you've got this big loud lure which is behaving differently, looks differently and is heaps bigger. And again, for a big tuna which is always swimming, always needs to eat, always needs to have energy, them grabbing a bigger bait is going to get more nutrients for that one hit. So, yeah.
So why are you running small lures then?
No, it could frighten them. Bang. It still could frighten them, and that's a risk I'm not willing to take. Right?
So, you don't want to.
You know, that's right. You guys are certainly, you've been proving that theory, but that's all right.
But you think once they cross the Tasman there, they switch over to small lure fascination, the tuna?
Yeah, well, there's lots of small lures and some of those big, there's lots of small bait. Some of those big ones could scare them. So, you know, it's just better off to stay to 6-inch, you know.
Well, let's talk about things that tuna eat, because you've found some weird stuff in their stomach over the years. And I know that being a scientist, you've been informed of some weird stuff. What's some of the strangest stuff you've seen in their stomach?
Nothing too crazy. I mean, we found a drum lid, a plastic drum lid in one. That was quite different.
Yeah.
We found a calamari squid. So obviously it must have been feeding quite close to the bottom. We found a leather jacket, a reef leather jacket. So not even like a pelagic one, but like a six spine one that you'd see, you know, swimming about in the shallows in 6 meters of water. What else have we found? Crabs. Found some sand crabs as well. Which
so
is interesting.
Does this mean they're swimming along the bottom of the seafloor and scavenging for crabs, or are these like a pelagic crab?
Well, the crabs were definitely a sand crab that you'd see burying in the bottom, but the way it had, I think, maybe five or six sand crabs in its stomach makes me think they do come up to the surface, and I think I have seen them when I've been floundering and doing stuff at night with the spotlight. You see those crabs every so often coming up to the lights and swimming around, and I'd say that's probably what's happening. You know, at some point they're grabbing it while they're moving around pelagically, but there's no doubt while they're cruising around and they're close to the bottom, if they see, a leather jacket or a, what else would you get, a barber perch, which I've also found in the stomachs, the calamari, they're going to eat them. They're pretty opportunistic, you know.
Yep. King George Whiting, I've heard of that in the past as well.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. King George Whiting, calamari. Down there at like Apollo Bay and stuff, yeah.
Yeah,
so
yeah, right.
They really are garbage guts, and I guess that's why they'll eat such a large variety of offerings. If they see it and its nutrients, they're going to eat it.
Yeah.
Just scavengers in the sea, really.
Mm. Yeah. Like, and massive calamari, I've seen that, which, you know, this explains why sometimes they'll eat like a 16-inch odd size. I've seen some guys go a bit silly with it, you know. They're running like 16-inch blue marlin lures.
Yeah. Jesus.
Rodney Gillam. And
400-pound leader as well.
and the fish are eating them.
Yeah.
Like, I would think that would frighten them. It's like towing a small bucket around behind your boat. So 100%. quite incredible the variety of things that they're going to eat. So,
but then on the flip side, every so often you have days, and it has been like that the last few months down in Tassie, which is currently we'd probably class it as the off season. But the fish get so focused in on these small bait fish that they will not touch anything else. That includes casting, trolling lures which look exactly like these fish. They end up being, they're either really small squid or these fish called bellows fish. And you usually get one opportunity at them in the morning when they're sort of feeding a bit more actively, but then they'll be busting up all day and we just can't get a strike. It's amazing. And it's just amazing that they can go from being so opportunistic and hitting everything to not touching an absolute thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know. You get that and as that's well. Where people start to employ different techniques like pitching baits and whatever other secret things they've got up their sleeve. So it pays to be a thinking fisherman when it comes to tuna fishing, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Now, what about tackle, boys? What tackle are you running on these big dogs? Rods and reels.
Rightio. So I've got this season, I've even dropped down all Tiagra's 50 wides mainly. I used to run 24, now 37, all with 12 kilos of strike. I've even dropped down to running 30 wides, but with 37 kilo line, but with backing of 80-pound braid, which get about 700 metres on it. So each
which is plenty.
Mm. Oh, exactly right. So each rod's got pretty much at least 1,000 metres, so you're never going to get spooled. Mm. And by having it as light as possible, especially when you're in the harness, it's so much better for the angler. Mm. Even if the fishes get close, you can unclip from the harness, still hold the rod, and it's not a massive weight than what we used to run.
Yeah. Lockie, what sort of harness do you use out of interest?
Yeah, the Black Magic harness. Oh. It's just very, very handy. It's been absolutely flogged the last couple months, so that's been very, very... Yeah, beneficial, especially on the clients. They're crying pretty much for it.
I'm big on the braid harnesses, Jonah.
Are you, Dave? I don't think I've ever seen you with a braid in your boat.
No, but they look good. I've seen other people use them. Just teasing Jonah because he's very Black Magic. He's very passionate about his Black Magic. And they're a brilliant product, those harnesses, Jonah. So, yeah. And I know you buck the trend, don't you? You don't run the super expensive gear.
No. So... Are we talking about rods and reels?
Oh, your reels are pretty expensive, rods are very affordable.
They sure are. So as you know, I like a good deal. My reels are very similarly set up to Lockie. So pretty much, back in the day, everyone ran mono. That was the standard thing, you know. Mono straight through, 24 or 37. 24 was generally okay for capacity. But 37, I always found, was you're just running the gauntlet for that big fish. And you hear of people getting spooled on 50 wides. And usually it's because they're running 37 straight through. But once braid started to come through and you can have, 700, 800 metres of braid backing with a short sort of top shot of mono, that just changed the game completely. So all my reels have gone to that now. And it just means that even when if you get multiple hookups of... big bluefin, you don't have to stress so much about that you're going to get spooled. You just take your time. Well, not don't take your time, but just in a controlled manner, clear the spread, clear the other rods, and then when you're ready to go, turn around and start fighting, without all the chaos. Pretty much I use these 50 wides just back with braid and mono. All my rods, I suppose they vary. I've got some expensive bent butts, but I've also got a lot of bargain straight butts, in particular the Shimano backbones, which I absolutely love, and I've run them for many, many years, and they just work so well for me. I think the only thing I've done with them is remove the top guide and upgraded the tip to a silica carbide standard tip, and that holds up really well. Everything else about it's just perfect.
I've actually been doing this year, Jonah. I've gone down a class in the reels. I'm running the mid-range Tiernoses.
I've noticed that.
They're bloody beauties. Yeah. They do the job very nicely, those reels.
They might, but the one thing I don't like is the strike, the clicker. It just doesn't have the excitement of a Tiago. Don't you reckon, Lockie?
Calicas as well.
Yeah, like, I just don't like it.
So good, so much lighter, but if that clicker was a bit louder, you'd go buy 10 of them tomorrow, but they're just not. Yeah.
You just can't beat that growl of that Tiago 50 getting hammered.
The best noise ever.
No, you're right, but it's a different sort of excitement when you hear that high-pitched whirring.
Yeah, it's like a little scream. Yeah.
As the line comes
squeal
off the reel.
Yeah.
No, so yeah, you can catch these big fish on some inexpensive gear if you're just trying to gear up and get. And you don't need huge boats these days either. Like, we've got a bit of a bite happening down here in Victoria, and you're almost at an advantage with a little boat because you can throw it in off the beaches and have access to fish that other people can't get to.
Yeah, well, they're driving 90 to 100 k's to get down there.
Yeah, so it's not a rich man's sport as it once probably was. You can run a smaller boat, pick your weather windows. You can run well maintained but cheaper gear, and you can still be amongst 100 kilo plus fish. I think it's fantastic for the sport.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Especially the maintenance. That's probably the biggest thing that you just touched on. Like, a lot of my rods were all rollers, and they still are. But then you're starting to go back to just all guides, so much better. You got no maintenance on them. Like, even doing the guides, like with the clients, you just grab these rods. No one really teaches you about the maintenance, and you look at them, they're all salted up with, and then especially you're doing braid on top of that. It's not running, it's cutting your braid. You really got to be on top of your gear all the time, especially on these fish of a lifetime.
Maintenance matters, and that's the other good thing that we've got these days with tackle technology. You can get really nice rods that actually don't have roller guides. That's one less thing to look after, because we're all busy in life. We don't have time. Not everyone has time to be tinkering with their tackle, playing with their tackle all the time. So there's some fantastic options out there tackle wise when you're chasing the big bluefin boys. So, all right, guys, anything else we want to touch on with the tuna fishing? Because we've got the tuna fishing extraordinaires in the house here at Wind Against Tide before we log off and come have a chat to some of the guys that are starting to wander past the stall today.
Probably just safety as well. Probably another thing just touch on yes. as well. Just because we're always offshore, and like we've heard about a couple stories even recently up the coast, and there's probably been, especially the social media, seeing more and more whale breaches out of nowhere. Something that we haven't really been exposed to as much. But just like having all the right EPIRBs, having a plan, all your radios in date, because we're always going out there, we're always going to push the limits to a degree, but know your weather, know what you can get away with, what you can't, and just be always on top of your game, service your life jackets.
I think there's been a bit of a trend recently of people are starting to push it a little bit with the weather too. So, and that's fine as long as, you know, that's the risk that you're taking, and if you're experienced, that's fine. But it takes one bad wave, one bad get yourself in the wrong position, and not only are you in trouble, but you've got rescue, you know, Coast Guard and police and etc. coming out and risking themselves to save you. So, I mean, we know that the fish can bite well in rough weather, but it's
a limit.
Yeah, you got to know your limits, don't you?
Exactly. Yeah.
And you know, I think it's people. There's more and more people pushing it harder and harder because, you know, no boats out when it's rough, and the fish tend to bite a bit harder, but. You do. You got to be mindful. And coming back in and out of entrances. I know you come back through a bar crossing quite frequently, Lockie. Yeah. In Block Bar. Pretty notorious.
Very notorious. Yeah, it can be very unpredictable at times. And you always think, oh, yeah, I'm clear. I'll go out. And then you get that last one that stands up. The amount of times I've had massive barrel wave land on the bow and just hold on.
Sounds like you've got it sorted then.
Yeah. No, I've had some scary experiences. But again, it's just, backing yourself, having the experience. It's not like it's my first time ever going over it. But again, you can have all the knowledge in the world and stuff still happens.
Yeah, they just pop. Yeah. You can't predict every situation that's going to arise. You just got to be well prepared for it, don't you, Jonah? You know me. Preparation is key.
100%. The thing is, with so many fishos, you spend so much time preparing for gear and for the trip of your lifetime, but a lot of the times you just neglect the safety gear. You know, you just throw it in there, you expect it to be fine, hasn't been looked at properly, hasn't been serviced, you know, don't know where it is, it's jammed under other piles of other gear, and when things go bad, it happens quick and it happens fast. So this is probably something for another podcast, Dave, but I mean, recently I had quite a humbling experience about a year ago. Up until then, I was very confident, been fishing offshore for many years, fishing in bad weather for many years. Especially after I got my new boat, or Dave's old boat, the Cootercraft Gunshot, you know, I felt almost invincible with that thing. You know, I knew I could fish in just about anything the weather would throw at me, and I just about did. Anyways, I had one day where things turned bad, and I felt like I was quite close to having to put a mayday out.
Oh,
and and that I got out of it unscathed, but that changed me. I still haven't got the confidence I had previously.
Yeah.
Yep. And I reassessed everything, and like I said, when things go bad, it happens quick.
Yeah, Mother Nature, she's a beast.
Yep. She is. Hey, that's a quick g'day to everyone who's here watching live at the boat show, but also a quick g'day to the guys that are watching on the live feed. Paul Nayers said, how is it there today? It looks busier than I thought it would be. It's bloody flat out here, Paul. We've got stuff going out left, right and centre. Dave Jurisic is in the background there trying to get some hoodies sorted for me. Yeah. He's doing a great job, so flat knacker, mate. So hopefully everyone gets down here over the weekend, comes and has a chat to myself and Jonah. You can catch Lockie for probably another couple of hours. He's going to hang around for a little bit. Yeah. And then heaps of big names and really cool stuff to check out at the boat show here this weekend. So looking forward to seeing everyone. Well, lads, thank you both for coming on the show. You've kicked off our campaign for the weekend. It's been a bloody beauty. Anything else you want to add?
Thank you very much.
All right. Logging off for our first live podcast from the Melbourne Boat Show 2023. Don't forget to come down and check out our stall, everyone, and we'll see you then.